Well, this morning I'd like to look together at the 130th Psalm that we read together earlier on. And I'd like us to consider this psalm under four headings. Our first heading this morning is the psalmist's cry. The psalmist's cry. This is verses 1 and 2. So as the psalm begins, the author is not in an enviable position. The words he uses, he says, "I'm in the depths. I'm in deep water. I can't find a foothold. I'm overwhelmed by this foaming and churning torrent. Any attempts that I might make to swim to safety are futile. I'm sinking fast. I'm going down, down, down. The prospect of drowning is looking increasingly a reality." Put yourself in his situation for a minute. Imagine that you are no longer standing on the safety of the river bank. You've lost your footing. You've fallen in. You're immediately engulfed by the turbulent water. What would you do? What could you do? And I suggest there's only one thing you could do, and that's exactly what the psalmist does. You would cry out, you would call for help, you would appeal for rescue. This picture of a drowning man that the psalmist uses is surely one of the few pictures that can do justice to the desperate situation in which he finds himself, with the urgency of his appeal for help. Of course, it is a picture. He's not literally drowning. But the picture he uses describes the extreme nature of his plight. It's a picture that's warranted by the nature of his situation. So the first part of the psalm, then, is a prayer. But this is no carefully constructed petition. It isn't the product of hours of thought and reflection. No, this is the urgent cry of a man who is in dire straits. He may not be physically drowning, but the situation that he's in seems so hopeless, his circumstances seem so desperate, that he's overwhelmed. He's beyond helping himself. He's beyond the help of those who are nearest and dearest to him. So he knows that there's only one course of action that's open to him, and he cries out to God for rescue. Notice the urgency of his language. "O Lord, hear my voice," he says. "Let your ears be attentive to the voice of my plea for mercy." He doesn't content himself with just a single shout for help. He repeats his call. The one concern that he has is that he should be heard. He's not interested in eloquence. He's not interested in impressive sounding language. No, he knows that he has only one hope. His need is such that God and God alone can help him. And so he channels all his energy into this cry for help. And we should notice something else about this cry. At the end of verse 2, the basis on which he cries to the Lord for help. The cry is a cry for mercy. "Let your ears be attentive to the voice of my pleas for mercy." This is a man who's conscious that God, the God to whom he's crying, is under no obligation to him. He's asking the Lord to deal with him in mercy, i.e., not according to what he deserves. He knows that if the Lord were to deal with him as he deserves, then there would be no hope of deliverance for him. And yet, in spite of his plight, he knows this one thing about the God to whom he cries, that this God is a God of mercy. This is a God who delights to show kindness to people who are only worthy of punishment. And so as he cries out, it's not just in vain optimism, hoping for the best. He cries out with confidence. So I'd like to ask you this morning, if you're a Christian, what do you do when you find yourself in the depths like this man? Perhaps you're overwhelmed by your circumstances. One difficulty seems to come on top of another. There seems to be no respite. Perhaps you're conscious of the effects of your failing health or advancing age. Maybe you've been let down by other people, people on whom you should have been able to rely. Perhaps you're conscious of your own failure in some area of your life. And the situation seems completely hopeless. All the usual footholds that you've relied upon have given way. You may have family and friends who are seeking to help and who are doing what they can. But even those who are closest to you seem powerless to prevent you from sinking down into despair. Well, if that's the kind of situation you're in, or if you're conscious of having been in that kind of situation, the same remedy is open to you that was open to this psalmist. There is hope. You may cry out to the Lord. You can cry out to him, knowing that he is a merciful God, knowing that he's a faithful God who keeps his promises, a God who makes a covenant with his people and who keeps that covenant. He's a God who loves to show mercy, to deal kindly with his children in spite of all that they deserve. So don't hesitate to cry out to him. Don't hold back because you maybe think you can't find the right words to say. Cry out and go on crying out. Don't rest until you know that he has heard and answered your cry. So that was the psalmist's cry. And then secondly, as we come to verses 3 and 4, we see the psalmist's concern. The psalmist's concern. So we thought about this man, the author of this psalm. We thought about the fact that he describes himself as being in the depths, utterly downcast, in a state of near despair. And Christians can be in that kind of situation for a variety of reasons. As we've already mentioned, health problems, bereavement, economic hardship, and so on. But as we come to verses 3 and 4, it becomes clear that the psalmist has a very specific reason for his despondency. And it's summed up in the form of a question. If you, O Lord, should mark iniquities, O Lord, who could stand? If you, O Lord, should mark iniquities, O Lord, who could stand? The psalmist here has a concern. He's concerned about his ability to stand. Well, what does he mean by that? Of course, he's not talking at a physical level. He's not saying that he has a problem with his legs. Rather, we can get an idea of what his concern is by maybe looking at other Old Testament passages that talk about standing in the same way. So perhaps if you'd like to turn back in your Bible a few pages to the 76th Psalm. Psalm 76 and verse 7. Psalmist addressing the Lord and says, "But you are to be feared. Who can stand before you when once your anger is aroused? From the heavens you uttered judgment. The earth feared and was still. When God arose to establish judgment to save all the humble of the earth." So the psalmist here is asking the same question as the psalmist in Psalm 130. Who can stand? And the context here is the context of God's judgment, his anger, his meting out of justice to human beings. So the question is, who can stand in the face of that judgment? Who can face that judgment? Who can emerge from it unscathed? And then another passage, this time in the prophecy of Amos, in chapter 2. Amos chapter 2, and verse 12. But you made the Nazarites drink wine, and commanded the prophets, saying, You shall not prophesy. Behold, I will press you down in your place, as a cart full of sheaves presses down. Flight shall perish from the swift, and the strong shall not retain his strength, nor shall the mighty save his life. He who handles the bow shall not stand, and he who is swift of foot shall not save himself, nor shall he who rides the horse save his life. And he who is stout of heart among the mighty shall flee away naked in that day, declares the Lord. So here, Amos the prophet is telling the people of Israel about God's judgment that's going to be coming upon them because of their rebellion and their unfaithfulness to him. And he's saying that this judgment is sure. It can't be resisted. Mere military strength won't stand up against it. He who handles the bow will not stand. So when the psalmist here talks about standing, he's talking about standing in the face of God's judgment. He's talking about coming to that judgment and emerging from it unscathed. That's what it means to stand. And as he asks the question, we see the reason for his concern. He's concerned because he's aware of his iniquities. If you, O Lord, should mark iniquities, O Lord, who could stand? The psalmist is conscious of the fact that his life doesn't conform to God's standard. He's contrasting himself with the uprightness that God requires. And as he does that, he's aware that his conduct is warped and twisted. It's marked by disobedience to God's commands. And so in the light of these iniquities, in the light of the disobedience and the sin that he finds in his life, he's anxious about the fact that he is to face God's judgment. He says, if God marks all those iniquities, if he takes note of them, if he keeps a record of them, then things are going to be pretty grim for this man when the time comes for judgment. Surely he can't hope to stand. The only possible outcome is going to be destruction. The only possible outcome is going to be for him to receive the full measure of God's justice, the punishment that he deserves because of those iniquities. And surely everything he knows about God will lead him to the conclusion that God does keep a record of iniquities, because God is perfectly just. He's all-seeing and all-knowing. He's holy in every aspect of his character. It can't be consistent for this God just to turn a blind eye to iniquities. Well, it's against that background that the but at the beginning of verse 4 comes as something of a surprise. But, says the psalmist, but with you there is forgiveness, that you may be feared. So this God, the God whom we've just been thinking about as perfectly holy and just, is also known for his forgiveness. He's known for dealing with sinful people as though those people hadn't sinned. He's known for wiping clean that record of their iniquities, no longer keeping that record against them. He's known for accepting those people unreservedly, never once raising the question of their guilt again. So that those who are forgiven in this way will stand before him, will not be destroyed by the judgment. So this forgiveness of God comes as something of a surprise. But I think there's a second surprise here too that the psalmist uncovers, and that's the effect of God's forgiveness. The result of the forgiveness of God, according to the psalmist, is that he is feared. But with you, he says, there is forgiveness that you may be feared. Now surely that goes against all that we would instinctively expect. A God who keeps a strict account of iniquities and will not overlook the least of them, where we would expect such a God to be feared, held in reverence and awe by people like us who are conscious of their sins. But that's not what the psalmist is saying here, is he? He's saying that this merciful God, the God who forgives sins, the God who doesn't deal with people as they deserve, this is the God who will be feared by all those who have received this forgiveness. At first sight, it just all seems to be the wrong way around. Mercy and forgiveness don't seem to go with fear. But perhaps that's because we need to think more carefully about what the psalmist means by fear. You see, I don't think he's thinking here in terms of a fear of judgment, a kind of cringing fear that shrinks back from a holy God, a fear that's conscious of having offended this God and broken his laws, and so a fear that is expecting punishment for sin. No, the fear that the psalmist has in view here is one that's only known by those who have tasted the forgiveness of God. It's a fear that's known from people who have moved from a position where they're under God's judgment and his wrath and his righteous anger because of their sin, into a position where they're accepted by him, where they enjoy his blessing and his favour, to a position where they've been forgiven. And so for these people, that cringing fear, that fear of judgment, has been replaced by a new kind of fear. It's been replaced by a holy reverence that delights in the holiness and purity of God, and that trembles at the prospect of sinning against a God who has shown such kindness to them. Yes, there is still a deep sense of the purity and the perfection of God. There's a sense of his absolute justice and of the fact that he is angry with sin. But the fear that the psalmist is talking about here isn't motivated by a desire to escape from punishment. Rather, it's a fear that recognizes, yes, punishment is deserved, but it's a fear that rejoices that forgiveness has been received. And it's a fear that worships and serves God out of love and gratitude, and that fears to offend him, not because of the prospect of punishment, but because the whole thought of offending against such a gracious and kind God, well, that's just unthinkable. Let me ask you this morning, have you begun to fear God in this way? Have you moved from a position where you're simply afraid of judgment to one where you fear God like the psalmist does? Is it the case that you're still conscious that God's righteous anger is directed against you, that he's keeping a record of all your iniquities, and that he will hold you to account for them? And are you therefore afraid of death because you know that you will have to give that account of the way that you've lived, and that you will face everlasting punishment on account of that? Or is it true of you that you've come to a place of safety, a place of forgiveness, where you know that that record of your sins, your iniquities, has been wiped clean, so that you're no longer seeking to hide from God, seeking to escape his judgment? Instead, you're basking in the assurance of his forgiveness, and you're serving him with that holy fear in response to his love and his forgiveness. And then thirdly, this morning, we see the psalmist's patience. The psalmist's patience. This is verses 5 and 6. So the psalmist knows that he is forgiven. He's assured that he's no longer under that threat of God's judgment. He's confident that he will be finally delivered from what he deserves. But as he looks at his situation, there is still much that could cause him to be anxious or downcast. He's still living in this fallen world. He's still facing all the trying and the difficult circumstances that go with a life in this world. He's still living in a body that has sinful desires and impulses. He knows that the best worship that he can bring to God is spoiled on account of unworthy motives. And he's conscious that, yes, he has learned to fear the Lord, but he doesn't fear the Lord as he knows that he should. There's still a discrepancy between his current situation and the reality of his status as a believer. There's this element of not yet in his experience. He's not yet in that state where he's been brought out of this fallen creation and all that goes with it. He's not yet free from suffering and sickness. He's not yet free from the presence of sin and everything that goes with that. He's conscious of these not yets. And they create with him an intense longing, a longing for a final deliverance. And so he says in verses 5 and 6, I wait for the Lord. My soul waits, and in his word I hope. My soul waits for the Lord, more than the watchman for the morning. More than watchman for the morning. He pictures himself as a watchman standing on the wall of the city, keeping guard through the long, dark, cold night. And the watchman is there, straining his eyes, looking towards the east, looking for the first glow in the sky, the first few rays of the sun, heralding the start of the new day. But it's not so much a question of what the psalmist is waiting for, but rather who. He says that he's waiting for the Lord. And so the hope that he has isn't simply a hope that he's going to be delivered from suffering and pain, that he's going to be delivered from all the frustration of his current existence. It's a prospect that he holds on to of being with the Lord. The one from whom he's received forgiveness. The one whom he's learned to fear. Now, standing where he is in his Old Testament situation, no doubt the grasp of his future hope beyond death for this man is sketchy. But he has such a hope, and it creates a longing within him. And he expresses it in these poignant and heartfelt terms of the watchman standing on the wall. There's so much that he doesn't yet know, but he knows this, that he has a future joy that will consist of full and unbroken fellowship with the Lord who has forgiven him. He's assured of this, that in spite of this longing that he has, he's prepared to live in this state of not yet. He's prepared to wait for the Lord. He has patience in the face of that waiting, and that patience has a solid foundation. He says, I wait for the Lord, my soul waits, and in his word I hope. The patience that this man has is derived from his confidence in the words that God has spoken. He rests in what God has promised in his word. The same word that has already assured him that his sins are forgiven is the same word that gives him the final guarantee of deliverance beyond death. And if you're a Christian here this morning, then you already know something of the tension that the psalmist experiences here. The tension between now, my present situation, and the expectation of what is to come. Perhaps that tension is particularly acute for you at the present time. Perhaps the burdens of living in the fallen world are lying heavy upon you. The circumstances that you find yourself in are far from those that you'd have chosen for yourself. Perhaps you're aware that your progress in the Christian life, in becoming more like Jesus, is painfully slow. Well, I want to encourage you this morning to learn from the example of the psalmist. Learn from his patience. Learn to wait for the Lord. Learn to take him at his word, to believe the promises that are held out for you here in the scriptures, to rest in those promises, knowing that your future hope is secure. And then finally this morning, I'd like us to think about the psalmist's instruction. The psalmist's instruction, verses 7 and 8. So this man has been delivered from the depths. He's found hope and confidence based on the fact that he's received forgiveness from the Lord. And because of that, he's content to wait patiently for the Lord. But that doesn't mean that he's happy just to keep that comfort to himself. As he closes the psalm, he's seeking to bring the same hope to the wider community of God's people. He turns around to his fellow Israelites and he instructs them. He exhorts them to follow his example and hope in the Lord. O Israel, he says, hope in the Lord. For with the Lord there is steadfast love, and with him is plentiful redemption. But he doesn't just exhort his fellow Israelites. He backs up this exhortation with reasons, with solid arguments, why it makes sense, why it's good for them to hope in the Lord. He says, for with the Lord there is steadfast love, and with him is plentiful redemption. And perhaps you'll notice that there seems to be an echo here in the words that the psalmist uses with words that he's used earlier on in the psalm. So in verse 4 we have those words, but with you there is forgiveness that you may be feared. So we have, with you there is forgiveness. And then we have, with the Lord there is steadfast love. And then we have, with him is plentiful redemption. It seems that the psalmist wants us to join these things together, to link them together in our thinking. Forgiveness, steadfast love, redemption. And I think it's right that we should do so. Because when we thought about verse 4, I don't know if you noticed this, but we left one very important question unanswered. I hope you did notice that. It's the question, how can God forgive sinful men and women, boys and girls, and remain just? If we start from the assumption that this God is just, we know that he must keep a record of sin, that he can't just turn a blind eye to it. If he is to be true to his holy character, then he must punish sin. He must judge those who are guilty of it. Well, how then is it possible for him to extend forgiveness to his people? To people who, like the psalmist, cannot deny their iniquities. People who know that they deserve only the anger of God. Well, I think there are two statements in these last two verses of the psalm that help us to answer this question. The first statement is, with the Lord there is steadfast love. With the Lord there is steadfast love. The psalmist is talking here about the way in which the Lord relates to his people. He's talking about the fact that God relates to his people on the basis of a covenant. In other words, he makes a solemn undertaking, a solemn commitment to them. He undertakes that they will be his people and that he will be their God. This isn't down to anything that they have done. It's not something that they deserve. In fact, it's something that he does even though they deserve the opposite. The steadfast love that the psalmist is speaking about here is his covenant kindness towards his people. It's a kindness that is committed to them in spite of what they deserve. But then there's a second statement. With him, with the Lord, is plentiful redemption. God's people are forgiven, and they are the object of his covenant kindness. But all of that is only possible because of this word, redemption. That is the explanation of how God can forgive his people and deal with them in steadfast love, and yet at the same time remain absolutely true to his just and holy character. So in the Old Testament, as we've been thinking recently on Sunday evenings in our studies in the book of Ruth, to redeem someone was to secure their freedom by paying a price. So an Israelite who had fallen on hard times and ended up being sold into slavery, that person could be delivered from slavery if there was a near relative who would pay a sum of money. And that sum of money was the redemption price. It was the cost of securing the freedom of that person. And when the psalmist talks about redemption here, he isn't talking about a price being paid to deliver somebody from being a slave to another human being. No, he's talking about a rescue from something far worse than human slavery. He says in verse 8, he will redeem Israel from all his iniquities. So here the iniquities, the sins, the twistedness, the warped nature of human beings is coming to the fore again. That problem that caused the psalmist so much anguish in the first part of the psalm. He knows that God can't be true to his character and just overlook those iniquities. If God's people are going to be forgiven, if they're going to be delivered from that terrible prospect of judgment because of their iniquities, then a redemption price has to be paid. The psalmist knew that for people to be set free from the slavery of their iniquities, a price had to be paid. He probably understood very little about exactly what that price would be and how that redemption would be accomplished. But as we look back in the light of the New Testament, we know exactly how that redemption has been accomplished. We know that the price was paid on that first Good Friday when Jesus went to the cross. We know that in suffering and dying there, he paid in full the price for all his people's sins. He took that penalty that God in his justice and righteousness demanded, so that God could extend forgiveness to all who put their trust in Jesus. And so God can be and is true to his holy character, never once compromising his justice, because he caused his son Jesus to be punished in the place of sinners. So that if sinners, like you and I, come to Jesus and put our faith in him, then we will be freely forgiven and accepted by God and become the objects of his steadfast love. So as we close this morning, I want to ask you, on what basis are you expecting God to accept you? Are you hoping that somehow he will just overlook your sins? After all, you haven't maybe been as bad as some people you could think of. Or perhaps you think that the good things that you've done and your religious activity is somehow going to outweigh all those bad things that you know that you've done. Well, I hope you'll see from this psalm that neither of those approaches will stand up in God's sight. The only way for you to know that the problem of your sin has been dealt with is to know that Jesus has paid the price, has paid that redemption price for your sin. And I want to invite you this morning to come to him, to trust in him alone, to rest in that redemption price that he paid on the cross, that price that fully satisfied all of God's demands. And if you do that, then you will receive this full and free forgiveness that he has secured. And you'll know that you have this hope of everlasting life and that you will stand before God. Amen.